Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. A half century ago today, the commander of New York City Vice Squad led a raid to close down a gay bar in Greenwich Village. It's actually just a mile from where I'm sitting right now. Instead, that commander triggered something of a riot and helped to inspire a budding movement. The patrons and protesters who pushed back against police at the Stonewall Inn took part in an opening salvo in the fight for LGBTQ rights. This hour on Point, we look back at Stonewall at 50 and look forward to the state of gay rights today. Join us. What recollections do you have about gay life in America before Stonewall? What memories or questions do you have about that uprising or about its import for what followed? We'd like you to weigh in as we talk about the evolution of gay rights in the 50 years since. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. With me in studio right now, Eric Marcus. He's an LGBTQ historian and journalist, and he's host of the podcast Making Gay History, which seeks to uncover untold stories of the LGBTQ civil rights movement through the voices of the people who lived it. The current season focuses on the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising. Eric, welcome to On Point.
Delighted to be here, David.
So let's talk a little bit about life like a minute before Stonewall, right?
You mean when I was at Camp Luema in Sussex, New Jersey, when I was 10 years old, asleep?
Pretty much I wanted to spend the A and B segments on that alone. There's a lot of talk about
it. I had a girlfriend, too, so that's a long time ago.
Times have apparently changed, Eric.
Yes, we played cards and held hands, and that was all I ever wanted to do with girls.
That sounds I should have known. Sounds very nice, actually.
It was nice. Eva Newman, if you're out there, it was a wonderful relationship.
So this is in some ways painful, but you want to know how the country talked about gay and LGBTQ issues before Stonewall? Let's take a moment and listen to this historic clip. In 1967, 40 million Americans, at least an estimated 40 million, tuned in to watch CBS Reports' The Homosexuals. It was network television's first documentary on homosexuality. Host and interviewer Mike Wallace referred to the group as the most despised minority in the United States.
Homosexuality is an enigma. Even in this era of bold sexual mores, it remains a subject that people find disturbing, embarrassing, and the reluctance to discuss it. Yet there is a growing concern about homosexuals in society, about their increasing visibility. In preparing this broadcast, CBS News commissioned a survey by the Opinion Research Corporation into public attitudes toward homosexuality. We discovered that Americans consider homosexuality more harmful to society than adultery, abortion, or prostitution.
Boy, doesn't that sound great. I'm glad I didn't see that documentary when it was on the air. If you can imagine what it was like to labor under that kind of derision from CBS News, and you should have seen what Time magazine was saying about gay people in the 1960s also. It was a time when gay people were still a criminal in every state except for Illinois, homosexual acts, I should say. We were considered mentally ill, and the church didn't have very good things to say about us either.
Well, and sometimes still doesn't.
Still doesn't, yeah.
In many ways, one of the things I want to figure out is, before we get to Stonewall itself in a moment, how openly could gays and lesbians, for that matter, have relationships? How openly could they even acknowledge their orientation at that time?
People didn't talk about openly anything in those years. When I started interviewing people in 1988 for my history book, when people talk about their lives in the 50s and 60s, those who were active in the movement, the early movement, which began in 1950, they mostly used pseudonyms. It was very rare for people to use their real names because you could be fired from your job, lose your family, even be evicted from your home, and certainly kicked out of college if you were out. So the first time I heard anyone talk about being out was a woman named Ernestine Eckstein in an interview in 1965, the first person who mentioned the idea that gay people needed to be visible, but she also talked about the dangers, but that every movement needed its martyrs. And there were people like Barbara Giddings and Frank Kameny and Hal Call and Randy Wicker, but they were really very few and far between because of how much there was to risk. And Frank Kameny had already been fired from his job, so he in 1957, so he didn't have anything to lose.
We're going to play a couple of clips involving some of those folks, I think in part taken from your
podcast. And my archive, yeah.
So let's take Barbara Giddings and her partner Gay Lahousen. They were partners in life and partners in activism. In the mid-60s, they attended what was known as the annual Reminder Day outside Philadelphia's Historic Independence Hall. The intent was to remind Americans that gay people were being denied their constitutional rights.
Suits and ties and, you know, dresses for the women.
And that was one of the few things we agreed on at the time. All the groups, we hashed it out and decided that we were the bearers of a message, and in order not to attract attention to ourselves but to get to the message, we'd have to blend into the landscape, so we would look unexceptional.
Right.
So the idea was to confront people with their truth, but not to be confrontational.
Yes, absolutely. That was so. But people look back now and think of that as accommodationist or assimilationist, but they're looking through a contemporary lens. They have no idea what it was like to live at that time. And those people were incredibly brave. You look at those pictures, people are looking at them in their march. This was a protest march that started July 4th, 1965 and went for 5 years every year. You look at the people looking at them, it's like they're looking at people in the zoo. So this was the first time that gay people were out there publicly acknowledging who they were. We don't know what it was like. We can't know because the world is so different.
They're seeking to look as normal as possible, and people are condemning them as freakish somehow.
Yeah, and I did that when my first book was published in 1988 and I went on television to talk about it. I dressed in a blue button-down shirt and tried to come across as straight as I could so that people could hear my message, which I knew they wouldn't if I looked gay, whatever that looked like in 1988. So they were very sophisticated about marketing in 1965 as they introduced homosexuals to the larger public.
And before, in a moment, we talk about what actually took place at Stonewall, just take a second. You know, you told me before we started, you know, that was roughly the same year at which you were told by a sympathetic and friendly executive at the network that you worked as a journalist at CBS, hey, fella, you're not going to get on air. And the reason you're not going to get on air is?
Because I was gay. That was 1988 when I had my first book published.
Almost 2 decades after Stonewall.
Oh, yeah. When I went to journalism school at Columbia, I graduated in 84. There were two of us in our class who were out, and we were warned that it would ruin our careers to be openly gay in 88. And at CBS, I was the only out person in the morning news newsroom, and I was really supported by my colleagues, but I was the only one who was out. And then when I asked about whether it was possible for an openly gay person to be on the other side of the camera, I was told after a difficult conversation with an executive that they would never put an openly gay person on CBS National News as a correspondent in 88.
And let me just say, this man told that he couldn't be on the air because he was gay and would have looked gay, is wearing a checked button-up shirt, a pair of shorts, pretty much very close to what I was wearing yesterday at the NPR Bureau as I went about my business. Let's talk about Stonewall for a moment. There's so many fascinating things as I knew about it, but as I learned more about it in preparation for conversation today, this was this historic site. This rallying cry was a bar that had only been open for a couple years. It was controlled by the mob, as apparently were most gay bars in New York. And it was a place that derived a lot of its profits from blackmailing the married businessmen who came to meet other men.
Yep. Not exactly a place you'd want to go to, but it really was principally for young people. It was a young bar, mostly people in their 20s and 30s. And what's been so interesting to me is I interviewed a lot of people who had been there back 30 years ago when I started my interviews. It was a very balkanized place, so that you had two of every kind at Stonewall, but they occupied different sections of the bar. Two of every kind, like Noah's Ark.
Yeah.
So you had the drag queens controlling the jukebox. You had the button-down shirt guys up front. You had the street kids who would have to pass by the bar where the business guys were, and the business guys would look at the street kids askance. So it was a mixture of all kinds of people. But what made it so different, what made Stonewall different, was that it was a place where people could dance. And that doesn't seem extraordinary to us now, but for people then, being able to dance together, especially slow dancing, was something that was unique.
So the guy, the commander of the vice squad, says, we're going to shut this place down, right? You know, the cheap liquor, probably doing things illegal, the question of gays acting openly in embrace of their sexual orientation. It's been described as a riot at the time, described perhaps as a melee. You know, it's been described as an uprising. What actually took place there? What was it really?
It was an uprising. It was a melee. It was a riot.
Right.
It was all of those things.
It's a bit of a party. Like, it sounded like it was kind of people came and enjoyed themselves.
Actually,
as
first, yes, people were let out of the bar. The police raided it. They let most of the people out. Those who were gender nonconforming or dressed in what they considered inappropriately, they were arrested, or if they didn't have proper IDs. So people gathered outside the bar. This is 1:20 in the morning. People have been drinking for hours. So you'd go and watch your friends leaving, and they would make gestures. And at first, it started off as more of a party, as people gathered. But things got rough with the police. And a detail I love was that people started throwing coins at the police as dozens and then hundreds of people gathered. And it wasn't until I interviewed Sylvia Rivera, who's now an iconic figure, who's was a trans person. I asked Sylvia, why coins? And she said, the payoff. You came for your payoff, here's some more. And it started with coins, and then someone threw a rock, and then
payoff from the mafia, basically. The cops were corrupt. You're getting paid one way or another. You're getting paid to oppress us.
Yeah, you're getting paid to oppress us, and we're going to give you a little more change. So it was taunting them.
Mm-hmm.
And it started out with the kids, the street kids, who were like age 16 to 21, most of whom lived on the street, had nothing to lose. And they got pissed off. They had reason to be pissed off. And it escalated. And I've heard so many stories about what actually happened that night. But anyone who's ever been in a riot situation or with a large crowd, different things happen in different places. So multiple things happened that led to this rising tension and eventually the confrontation with the police.
And it wasn't just a single night. It took place over a series of nights. So that really was a way in which they could get attention and gather momentum and critical mass.
But it wasn't organized.
Yeah.
The organizing began before the six nights of conflicts ended, with a meeting organized by the Mattachine Society of New York and the Daughters of Bilitis, an organization founded in 1950 in L.A. and 1955 in San Francisco. So the what happened after Stonewall was built on the foundation of the existing movement, but drew in thousands of young people who'd had enough. But they'd also had experience in the Black Civil Rights Movement, the civil rights, the anti-war movement, and that's what helped propel the movement forward. All these new young people joining in.
They did this. We can do this too.
Exactly. And they also knew how.
As a result of having watched them.
Having watched and participated.
Uh-huh.
They knew.
They had taken part in these protests as well.
Sure, sure. Plenty of the people who were involved in the organizing were involved in those early protests, yeah.
We're talking with Eric Marcus. I want you to hold, Eric. And we'd like all of you to stick around as well. We're discussing the Stonewall Uprising 50 years ago today, how it shaped the LGBTQ movement and the state of gay rights. We'll be taking some of your calls, adding some great new guests. You can join our conversations. What questions do you have about the history of Stonewall and its legacy? How do you assess the evolution of LGBTQ rights over the last 50 years? How have your own thoughts changed? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing the history and the evolution of the LGBTQ movement on the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots. You can join our conversations. What questions do you have? How do you assess LGBTQ rights and protections in your own community? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With me is Eric Marcus. He's a journalist, something of a historian. He's host of the podcast Making Gay History. I wanted to... We'd been talking before the break a little bit about the movement and the way in which political consciousness seeped out. And you mentioned Frank Kameny. Frank Kameny was fired by the federal government from his civilian job as an astronomer in the U.S. Army in 1957 because he was gay, because you can't apparently have gay astronomy in the Army. He emerged as one of the most militant and important leaders of the early gay rights movement. In a 1989 interview with my guest, Eric Marcus, Kameny described what needed to change in his mind in order for gays and lesbians to achieve progress.
The movement of those days was a very unassertive, apologetic, defensive kind of structure, not taking strong positions, giving a hearing to everybody and saying all views must be heard, even those which were most harshly and viciously condemnatory, as long as it dealt with homosexuality, they must be given a fair hearing. Drivel. And we were sick. We were sinners. We were perverts.
How did Kemeny's conclusions get translated in how gay activism worked?
Well, what Kemeny did is he founded a new militant version of the Mattachine Society in Washington, D.C. in 1961 because he decided that if the government was going to declare war on him, he was going to declare war right back. And he was single-minded in his efforts, and he brought gay people into the public with protests in front of the White House, the State Department, and elsewhere, with people asking for their rights, actually asking in a way that people hadn't before.
I'd like to take a call now from Baltimore, Maryland. Ida's on the line. Ida, talk to us a little bit. What are your thoughts here?
Hi, David. I'm calling because, well, first of all, I'm really excited that Chris mentioned Sylvia Rivera because that's kind of what I'm calling about. I think I've been listening to all the Stonewall coverage in the last few days, and it's been really exciting. And I don't at all want to take away from the legal and social gains for homosexuality and other like non-hetero sexualities. But I think that something's been kind of lacking is like the importance of trans people in that history, like Sylvia and like Marsha P. Johnson and the street transvestites action revolutionaries and the gay liberation front. And just it being 50 years later, what I'm mostly thinking about is the really, really sordid state of trans rights today. Violence, I think maybe lethal violence against trans people has gone up 80% in like the last few months. And I think in large part that's because of like politics around the world and places where trans people were gaining some traction, losing that traction, and mainly because of the activism of anti-trans pseudo-feminists who have been trying to paint trans people as creeps who are somehow, first of all, never women, but also like having no right in spaces of any sort, and saying that we're trying to make kids go through sex changes, and like, I don't know, it's just that while that's all sounding very radical or antagonistic, I mean, we have articles coming from The Atlantic, The New York Times, The Guardian UK, that give a lot of validity to what's called like gender like skepticism, this idea that you can just sort of wonder about trans people and where they fit in society rather than listen to them and address their needs or find a way to include them.
Okay, Ida. Well, thank you for this. I want to actually put that a little bit to another of our guests. Ebony Bell is with us. She's editor-in-chief of TAG. It's a magazine spotlighting LGBTQ causes with a focus on women and minorities, but also trans people. Ebony, welcome to On Point.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
I wanted to introduce you in part because it seemed to me that one of the things that inspired your publication, the creation of your publication, was the idea that there was sort of a monolithic characterization of gays and gay rights that at times excluded people with different elements to their orientation or different elements to their demographics that went beyond being white and gay.
Exactly. I think when people think of the gay community, and I say gay because we use that term a lot, they think of gay white men. But we have to remember that our community, there's all different intersectionalities. And so before starting TAG, a lot of our publications and media, I would see white gay men. That's who advertisers were catering to. And I'm a black queer woman. So as a black queer woman, I'd like to see other people that look like me. So I decided to – I left my job because I felt like our stories were just as important. And so I started TAG to make sure that we were very intentional about telling the stories of LGBTQ women and being very intentional, making sure we're telling the stories of people of color and trans brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm. We also have with us by phone from Riverside, California, joining us is Democratic Representative Mark Takano. In 2012, he became the first openly gay person of color to be elected to Congress. He's also a member of the Congressional LGBTQ Equality Caucus. Representative Takano, welcome to On Point.
Glad to be here, David.
Thanks for making time for us today, sir. I wanted to ask you a little bit about, you've been there, I guess, 6 years now, a little over 6 years now. To what degree have you seen attitudes in Washington shift and become more inclusive in its understanding of how, of the varieties and varietals of sexual orientation and self-identity?
Well, my time in Washington, I've seen the sense of inclusivity increase. From the time I took office in 2013 and sat on the stage during President Obama's second inaugural address and heard him utter the remarkable words, Seneca Falls, Stonewall, and actually it was Seneca Falls, Selma, and Stonewall, and he included LGBTQ rights as civil rights as part of our civil rights narrative in our country. And that was an amazing moment to hear a president of the United States utter that phrase. But I have to say it's been really disturbing to endure the first 2 years of a Trump administration. We're seeing, in his defense policy for the Defense Department, an anti-trans policy. We're seeing rollbacks in terms of guidance at the Department of Education, and that's definitely setting the tone for making it all right to harbor discriminatory feelings. The way that they're conservative right is weaponizing the First Amendment in a very perverse way. To say that religious liberty means that people should be permitted to discriminate against LGBTQ people, and so I think there's an unsettled feeling. And I tell people, I tell young people today, I give them a trick question. In fact, I just did it in front of some young people a couple days ago. I said, "Do you think progress is inevitable?" And then a lot of them will raise their hands. I say, "Nah, wrong. It's not inevitable. As we can see, progress can be stopped, and it can even be turned back. And in terms of LGBTQ rights." I think there's that feeling right now.
You know, Congressman, I want to play a clip for you, you know, because it was striking to me. I attended the Republican National Convention in Cleveland in 2016, and their then-candidate Donald Trump became the first Republican nominee to mention LGBTQ citizens in an acceptance speech, and he used that term. He talked about the Orlando Pulse shooting, and he promised to he put it this way. He promised to protect the LGBTQ community from terrorists like ISIS.
As your president, I will do everything in my power to protect our LGBTQ citizens from the violence and oppression of a hateful foreign ideology. Believe me.
And there was another talk he gave, I think, if I'm recalling correctly, where he invoked LGBTQ citizens and got applause for it. And he says, it's nice to get applause from this crowd. I appreciate it. It's sort of saying, I'm glad to see Republicans or conservatives coming along. At the same time, there was this other episode involving Stonewall in 2017, where the National Park Service spent $66, according to E&E News, a reputable news outlet. After spending $66 to buy a 3x5 nylon rainbow flag, the National Park Service flew it at the flagpole outside Stonewall Inn, which is a part of a national park grounds. And then this raised all kinds of alarms within the Interior Department, at which point basically they transferred the flagpole and I think the flag itself to the ownership of the city of New York. Eric Marcus here is in studio. He's shaking his head ever so slightly. Correct
ever
us
so
on this,
slightly.
Mark.
I hate to correct you, David, because you've gotten virtually everything right in this discussion, which is so hard on Stonewall. But
it's the NPR motto, virtually everything right.
Virtually everything. The Stonewall National Monument is Christopher Park, which is directly across from the Stonewall Inn. That's owned by the federal government. The park itself within the fence is owned by the federal government. The sidewalk and the lamp and the flagpole are actually on city property. So they had to fly the flag on city property. But you'll see I don't know, dozens of rainbow flags at that national park at the moment. So,
so that is an important corrective. Representative Takano, I guess what I want to get at is that interesting tension, it seems to me, between the president at least explicitly saying affirming things about LGBTQ citizens in ways you really have not tended to hear from Republican leaders in that way, and this tension within the government itself among its officials.
Well, when candidate Trump said those words, if you listen carefully, what he's actually doing there is he's appealing to LGBTQ Americans in a way to weaponize LGBTQ rights again, in an Islamophobic way, in some ways, it is true that. That regimes in the Middle East, regimes that are Islamic regimes, do have anti-LGBTQ stances. But he had a very specific rhetorical and ideological purpose in the way he was appealing to the LGBTQ community. He has not followed through mm-hmm. in terms of using his power of the presidency to advance LGBTQ people. Much the opposite. He's singled out trans people as a way to marginalize them, and certainly through his defense policies, certainly through his Secretary of Education, certainly in the ways that he's allowed his minions to say that we're not going to fly any rainbow flags at embassies. And there have been clever ways around that in some of these embassies around the world, but he's certainly not shown himself to be true to his words. And let's be clear: the words he was using, in that clip, the first clip you played, were being deployed in a very specific way to fit the message of fear. Conjuring up all sorts of fear against Muslims, and he did that to the Muslim community in our country generally.
Mm-hmm. I want to play a clip, Ebony Bell, of another president a little bit ago, alluded to by the congressman a few moments ago. In 2012, as he was running for re-election, President Obama took what many observers at the time, at least, considered a pretty bold political gamble. And before the election, he declared his full support for gay marriage.
When I think about members of my own staff who are in incredibly committed monogamous relationships, same-sex relationships, who are raising kids together, when I think about those soldiers or airmen or Marines or sailors who are out there fighting on my behalf and yet feel constrained, even now that Don't Ask, Don't Tell is gone, because they're not able to commit themselves in a marriage. At a certain point, I've just concluded that for me personally, it is important for me to go ahead and affirm that I think same-sex couples should be able to get married.
You know, Ebony Bell, Joe Biden had basically signaled his vice president in a talk show on a Sunday, much to his chagrin, that that's where the administration was going to go. But how big a step was that for the president to take?
Oh, it was huge. It was a pivotal moment for political culture, for pop culture even. I think that Obama realizes with any movement that needs to move, allies need to step up. And he has one of the biggest platforms to do that. And I think with gay rights, any sort of civil rights, allies have really stepped up, and that's how things have moved forward. That's, I think it's how we basically had gay marriage, is because people stepped up. A lot of times when you're the one that's being vulnerable, whether it's black rights, civil rights, any sort of LGBTQ rights, we can scream till we're blue in the face. But it's when those allies really step up that people start paying attention. So it was a pivotal moment. And for me, I was proud to see someone who was an ally that had a huge platform to step up. And that's mm-hmm. what I hope to continue to see as we, you know, fight for trans rights and other equality rights moving forward.
Eric Marcus, briefly, I saw your eyes popping out of your head when you were listening again to the Obama clip. Why?
Yeah, and Ebony, I completely agree with what you said, because I thought Obama was crazy.
Huh.
I thought he'd gotten out ahead of public opinion, and I followed public opinion closely, and I thought it's rare for a politician to get out ahead of public opinion. I thought it was very brave, and I thought it endangered his possibility for being reelected, but what do I know?
And Congressman Takano, before we relinquish you at the end of this segment, briefly, sir, do you see what Ebony Bell describes? Do you see opinions changing, the arc bending, as Obama often put it, for trans people and their rights and recognition in society, as we've seen for gay and lesbians?
I think President Obama pushed the envelope for trans people toward the latter part of his administration. There's any number of measures that he took. I can relate to the moment that President Obama announced that he was going to move toward supporting same-sex marriages. Mm-hmm. I was scared. I hope to say I was scared that it was going to endanger his reelection, and I thought it was a brave moment. And I'll repeat, when I heard on a president utter, as he did in his second inaugural speech, Seneca Falls, Selma, and Stonewall, placing us firmly in the narrative of civil rights, that did so much for all Americans, and especially LGBT people of color.
Sure.
I can't tell you what that meant to feel included.
An illusion of real consequence. Representative Takano, thank you so much for joining us today.
Welcome. Thank you.
And please, Ebony Bell and Eric Marcus, we want you to stick around. And to our listeners, please stick around with us. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're discussing the LGBTQ movement. It's 50 years to the day after the Stonewall riots began, just a few short subway stops away from our studios here in New York City. You can join our conversation. What are your questions about the evolution of LGBTQ rights over the past half century? What ground remains to be covered? How has it played out in your own circles, your own family? Follow us on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. With me in studio, Eric Marcus. He's a journalist and a historian and host of the podcast Making Gay History. Ebony Bell is editor-in-chief of TAG, a magazine serving the LGBTQ community. And we're interested in your calls. I'd like to start this segment with a few calls from about your experiences. Kathleen is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Share with us your thoughts on this.
Well, hello. I went to my first gay and lesbian dance just months after Stonewall. Mm-hmm. Madison's Gay Liberation Front organization started on the heels of Stonewall. And I went on remaining very involved in gay rights and politics, local politics, and I became the first out lesbian elected to office in the state of Wisconsin shortly after Wisconsin had become the first state to pass an anti-discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation law.
Huh.
And then was appointed by our governor to chair the committee to let the state know we were serious about the law and that we had a very supportive regime to enforce the law. My point in calling is just that as glad as I am that Stonewall is getting the appropriate notoriety, I'm wearing my rainbow gear head to foot today.
Uh-huh.
But I also don't want it to be thought that this was a coastal event, particularly just an east or far west coast event. Most of it was actually going on for the 1970s to mid-80s here in flyover country. And that, in fact, the nation's first gay rights law was signed by a Republican and put into effect and administered by a Democrat.
Well, thank you for that, Kathleen. Of course, you know, events that happen wherever they happen can inspire events nationwide. One of the things I love about this show is it reaches people all over the country. Eric, it sounds like you have some tie to Wisconsin. You seem very enthused in this moment.
Well, my partner's from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We were just there this past weekend for his brother's wedding. And yes, so much went on in the rest of the country, in the Midwest. There was a national convention of the Mattachine Society in 1959 in Denver, Colorado, in Kansas City in 1966, another convention of gay rights organizations. I'm a New Yorker. I tend to be a bit of a chauvinist, and I like to think New York was first with a lot of things. We weren't even first with the first Pride March in 1970. The first one was in Chicago on June 27th, 1970. New York was June 28th. And we weren't the first place where gay people fought back against the police. We didn't have the first gay rights bill. Those things happened in lots of smaller communities around the country. In the Midwest, Wisconsin was actually very, very important.
And also there were events in California that sort of anticipated Stonewall, if I recall correctly, that it turned out to be a seminal moment, but at the same time was not the first moment.
Yeah, so. In California, in San Francisco, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, yes, there were confrontations earlier. And I recognize who your caller was. I'm almost in tears hearing her voice and hearing her story because there are so many heroes out across the country, and we don't know most of them. And I never got an opportunity to interview that guest, so I'm glad that you had her on the show.
I'm glad to have provided that moment. From Detroit, Michigan, we have a call from Thomas. Thomas, tell us your thoughts. Share your experience.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. As a queer and trans person, just talking about the state of the gay pride movement now is very difficult because what we see now in the marches that we have and the inclusion of... Yes? Yes?
I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
Sorry. So what we have now in the inclusion of these marketing campaigns tooled towards us and all of these different corporate elements in Pride, we're seeing a movement that's been taken over by the forces that were supposed to be the opponents of the queer power. It's very much a co-optation. We're seeing banks who deny loans to queer people. We're seeing companies that pour money into anti-queer candidates at Pride, marching instead of queer people, taking up a queer space. And that really does speak to the way that this movement that started as a queer power movement, not a gay pride movement, a queer power movement, has been defanged and made obsolete. And we need it more than ever now. We will need queer power to survive these threats being levied against us every day. And it didn't start with Trump. It started long before. Yes.
I'm sorry. I was going to just ask before I let you go, how do you identify?
Oh, I'm a non-binary trans person, and I am queer.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. Let me share that with my guests. Appreciate your call. Ebony Bell, on my way to work today, I saw a big poster by the I think it was an electronic one, so it shifted. But I saw a big poster from Airbnb by the subway sort of advertising gay pride and explicitly tying it to the moment. Google, I think, is sponsoring a float in the Gay Pride parade in San Francisco. In some ways, that seems obvious and clear cut. On the other hand, some of their employees internally have signed a petition asking, as I understand it, for them to be denied because of YouTube's inability to crack down effectively on these guys who have made incredibly homophobic criticism of a gay media critic for Vox Media named Carlos Maza. You know, isn't it in some ways a good thing for corporate America to get behind this? I mean, when there was the civil rights movement, you know, Coca-Cola being supportive of civil rights was important for Atlanta, important for the Fortune 500 or however we thought of major markets and capitalism at that time. And yet there is this tension that you've heard from Thomas about the idea of are we being displaced by corporate actors? What do you make of all that?
I think it depends. I think I'm sure you're familiar with the Human Rights Campaign. So they have something called the Equality Index. And they basically measure and look at companies within the internal organization, how they treat LGBTQ people. Are they hiring transgender people? I think it's good to see companies like that step up. However, right here in Capitol Pride in Washington, D.C., we've seen companies that do the complete opposite of that, but they're carrying rainbow flags. I think it's time for us to just be smarter. I think it's good for us to have visibility with corporate companies, but I think we just need to be smart about how we do it, and we don't just let anybody come in that says, hey, you know, we like you guys for the month of June. We have to be way smarter than that. And I don't know what the answer is to that. But I know here in D.C. we have a group called No Justice, No Pride. And they're calling out that exactly. And they've put down some groundwork, some rules, and Capitol Pride's listened to them because they have a point. Why do you not have black and brown people on your board? Why do we not see transgender people on your board? Things like that, because when you have black and brown people, transgender people, then you have those people that can come to the table and say, wait a minute, why do we have X, Y, and Z company here represented when they don't care about us? So I think it depends. I'm all about visibility. I always say visibility is the best form of activism, but I don't want your visibility if you don't care about our community.
Mm-hmm. We've been hearing about the questions of corporate life, and there's a question of pop culture, right? You think back to April 1997, and in a sense, it's kind of a Stonewall moment for pop culture. Maybe, Eric Marcus, you tell me. That's an evening when 42 million viewers turned into the sitcom Ellen to see the program's lead character, played, of course, by Ellen DeGeneres, reveal that she is gay.
This is so hard, but I think I've realized that I am. I can't even say the word. Why can't I say the word? I mean, why can't I just say? I mean, what is wrong? That why do I have to be so ashamed? I mean, why can't I just say the truth? I mean, be who I am. I'm 35 years old. I'm so afraid to tell people. I mean, I just, Susan, I'm gay.
2 weeks before that show aired, Ellen DeGeneres gave an interview to Time magazine that revealed she was gay. Eric Marcus, how important was that?
Oh, it was landmark. Again, we can't imagine today what that moment was like. I was at a party with my partner and 200 lesbians on 23rd Street and 9th Avenue. And the host of the party was Ann Northrup, who's one of the co-organizers of the Reclaim Pride Coalition Queer Liberation March coming up on Sunday in New York, which is a protest march, in contrast to the traditional march here, which I'll be marching in, the protest march. It was a huge moment. Very few people of Ellen's stature had come out at that point. Actually, she was probably the most, other than Greg Louganis, who I worked with on his book, Breaking the Surface.
The Olympian.
Yes, who came out in 95, about being gay and having HIV, which was a huge national story. It was a big shift, a huge shift, but she paid a big price for it. She
That show went off the air within a year or so, right?
It did. It was a terrible transition for her. I got to interview her during her low point where she didn't think she'd have a career anymore, that her career was over. She felt she had to do it at that time for her for personally, but it cost her. She had no idea she'd wind up doing what she did and becoming one of America's most important cultural figures and a leader in the LGBTQ civil rights movement, whether or not she's really an activist.
I want to take a call now from Norfolk, Virginia. Ellie is on the air. Ellie, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up an important point that I felt was worth mentioning, and just that one of the big debates in a lot of politics in the past few years on both sides has been about healthcare. And I feel like some of the most vulnerable groups in discussing healthcare and when healthcare is being taken away are queer and trans people, especially of color. Given that we rely on a lot of federal services and programs to be able to afford certain services. And I feel that's not a point that gets brought up very often in the healthcare debate, but it's a really important one, especially for our community.
Thanks, Ellie. I appreciate that. Ebony Bell, how often do you see that issue come up as your magazine covers issues that focuses, among others, very much on what trans people experience?
Too much. This is incredible timing. I was just actually reading about how trans people navigate being intimate with partners. And they're, especially for trans men, I think there were maybe one or two resources or books out there. So unfortunately, we see it way too much. I think there is a lack of resources. I think there is also somewhat of an attack, and I think they kind of correlate with one another on the transgender community. What's happening is we have a failure to protect and educate this vulnerable group, which ultimately encourages us not to care and encourages violence as well. So I think there's some correlation there that this is just a forgotten group. And we have to remember that if we're silent, we can't do anything for this group of people. And that goes for healthcare, that goes for all kinds of protections and rights for the transgender community.
We have a call now from Arlington, Massachusetts. I'd like to take Gabe. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a history teacher in the Boston area. I teach high school history. And I've been interested to hear what your guests and people who are calling in have been talking about. You know, originally this was a gay power, not a gay pride, you know, movement. And I guess my question especially for the historians among your guests, what history do you think is important for high school students to learn? And specifically, we'd like to sort of phrase our lessons in terms of an essential question. So sort of what question do you think this history asks?
Eric Marcus, handle that question for me.
Yes, well, actually, the Making Gay History podcast started out as an educational project working with a Massachusetts-based organization called History Unerased at unerased.org. And we've created curriculum materials that are anchored by Making Gay History archival audio for 8th and 11th grade American history, LGBTQ-inclusive American history. So the material's out there now. You can find it on our website at makinggayhistory.com. These stories need to be taught to all kids because our LGBTQ history is actually threaded throughout American history. Byard Rustin was gay, and we're not taught about that. At least I wasn't when I was in school. The Lavender Scare was concurrent with the Red Scare. So it's a long discussion to go into about the appropriate questions to ask, but the materials are out there, and kids are hungry for this information, and educators are hungry for the resources. So they're there.
Even as we talk about you know, sort of things moving in a certain direction, it's not all moving in that direction. And there are fissures within society and people who move at different speeds or aren't moving at all. The United Methodist Church is actually moving, but it's moving towards a split. And that's over its ban over LGBT clergy and over the question of same-sex marriage. In March, the denomination's first openly lesbian bishop, Karen Olivito, told NPR's Morning Edition she doesn't want to see the church break up.
My commitment is not to have anybody leave, but this is what I know. This decision has caused a shockwave of trauma across the church and around the world. There are hurting people in our pulpits and in our pews, and we have a lot of pastoral care to offer.
Ebony Bell, I can imagine what you'd like to see happen, the church embrace this, but in this closing minute before we go, what is the constructive path for an institution that can't quite reconcile itself, perhaps, to where you'd like to see policy now, and yet still wants to play a role in broader America?
That's a good question. I think there's a reason that we're seeing young people moving away from the church. And this is just one of the many reasons, whether it's Methodist, Black church, whatever. And I think if these churches, these institutions really want to bring people back to community, back to religion, they really need to take a step out and figure out why are they not progressing with the times. I think that's what it always is about, whether you're, let's say you're a company, you're an institution, and you're still doing the same things over and over again, and you're not progressing with the time, this is what happens. In 5 years, if you're not there, this church is going to, your church is going to collapse. It's just going to collapse. And I think there's a lot of...
Go ahead. They're facing, in some ways, a history play out in front of them. We've been hearing there the insight of Ebony Bell. She's editor-in-chief of Tag Magazine. Ebony, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Eric Marcus, host of the podcast Making Gay History. Delighted to have you here.
Thank you, David. A pleasure.
Folks, you can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. And don't forget to sign up for our newsletter. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Down, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, Grace Tatter, and Adam Waller, with help from Alex Reese and Sydney Wertheim. Our executive producer, my boss, that's Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.